I think all you need as we go along this evening is a little handout. And just to say that roughly speaking, the first half is in the medical world. And roughly speaking, the second half, we're going to be more opening up the Bible together. And we'll probably therefore have our break at the end of the sort of more clearly medical section. So, to begin, last year a journalist called Damien Thompson wrote this book called The Fix. It's a pretty hard-hitting book. It's partly driven from the fact that he has struggled with alcohol addiction himself. And in his book, in the opening section, he sort of sums up something of where we're at culturally. He says this: addictions to iPhones, painkillers, cupcakes, alcohol and sex are taking over our lives. Our most casual daily habits can quickly become obsessions that move beyond our control. And very importantly, he says, addictive behavior is becoming a substitute for family and work bonds that are being swept away by globalization and urbanization as whole societies set about fixing themselves. So that's something of the cultural setting that we're in. But if there's any doubt that it's really true, his opinions and his claims, just some figures to put on some of those things.
Well, the computer has decided to die. let me just...
if you give me 1 second, hopefully it should be working again. Ah, there we go. Brilliant. Some figures from the health service. The number of admissions to hospital for alcohol-related conditions was just over 1 million in 2009 to 2010. You can see there's a slight difference between these, which are solely attributable to alcohol, and other more complicated situations. It cost the NHS £2.7 billion in 2007, alcohol-related problems. And the charity Alcohol Concern predicts that the number of admissions will reach 1.5 million by 2015, if we keep going on this trend, and that the cost will be £3.7 billion a year by 2015. Alcohol-related diseases account for 1 in 8 bed days in hospital. So about an eighth of bed occupancy is to do with alcohol. It's not just alcohol, of course, it's other drugs as well, but it's more difficult to get figures for some of them. The criminal justice system, about 10 years ago, the government commissioned some research which found that around about $7.3 billion a year was the cost to the criminal justice system for alcohol related problems. That's 10 years ago, of course, a bit more than that now. Also, at the same time, about £6.4 billion was lost per year in the workplace due to alcohol misuse. And of course, as I said already, figures for other drug uses and other addictive behaviours are more difficult to put a figure on. But in the mid-1990s, a large report was done on the effect of drugs on criminal behaviour, and something like, it's hard to estimate, between 6 and 24% of acquisitive offences, that sort of things like burglaries, were committed by heroin users. So it's a very significant effect on our criminal justice system. What about non-substance problems? Well, in 2010, the British Gambling Prevalence Survey estimated that just under 500,000 over 16-year-olds meet the criteria for gambling addiction in Britain. And I'll come on to some stats on sort of internet things a bit later. The point is that addictions are a hugely significant feature of modern life and cause a great variety of problems. What we're going to look at this evening, if to give you a structure, is three questions. How do you define addiction? What's the cause? And what can be done about them? A year ago, in the Lent lecture that I did then on sort of general mental health problems, I suggested it would be helpful to think of any mental health problem as having four main contributory factors. These are the three main ones that we would have looked at as a psychiatrist: biological, psychological, and social factors that work together to cause mental health problems. I suggested back then that We're missing out if we forget the fact that as human beings, we are also spiritual beings. We have a spiritual heart because we're made in God's image. And I also put the Bible there at the top as our number one authority, our top authority as Christians. But already you can see that if a mental health problem has got factors in these four areas that contribute to it, then we're not dealing with something that's simple. And therefore, there are no simplistic solutions to these problems. We're dealing with an issue that in fact, with addictions, goes to our hearts. It goes deep into our hearts. And so there's a warning from the prophet Jeremiah for us. He said this, that the heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure. Who can understand it? So we're not going to get all the answers this evening. But I'm going to suggest that to sort of deal with it, we'll look at these four areas to help us have a framework for thinking about addictions. Now, not necessarily every person who's got an addiction problem will have a problem in each of the four areas, but it's a useful checklist and a good way to sort of work our way through it and build up the picture of what is going on. So we'll look at each of these four areas, and for each one, we'll look at the two questions of definition of addiction and cause, and then we'll pull things together and think about what can be done. So firstly then, biological models for addiction. I'll put that down on your sheet. From a biological perspective, from a sort of medical perspective, what is an addiction? Well, let's think first about addiction to various substances. And we need to be introduced to the concept of psychoactive substances. These are chemicals that once they're in our bodies, they get into the blood and then they cross over a barrier into the brain and can affect our nervous system. And those that are addictive because they affect our brains in a way that is positively pleasurable and usually quickly positively pleasurable. Some of these drugs are addictive but don't cause huge problems. So something like caffeine is quite addictive. But the problems that it causes are relatively mild, particularly if you take it in moderate amounts. Although if you've tried to get clear of it, you'll know that it is addictive. So here's my first addiction confession tonight, and it's the only one you're going to get. That's second flush single estate Assam tea. I would suggest it's the best way to start the day. But fortunately, in moderation, it's not too bad for you at all. In fact, there's probably some good benefits as well. But many other substances can cause huge damage. And we've already started to think about the medical, social, and psychological damage associated with excess alcohol, nicotine, heroin, cocaine, amphetamines, and various other things. There's an immense amount of damage that can be caused, not just on the level of being intoxicated and the dangers that can come with that, but when it develops into regular harmful use and eventually to full physical dependence on a substance. So what does that sort of full-blown addiction or dependence look like? Well, just put down there for you the features of addictions as defined by the World Health Organization's classification of mental and behavioural disorders. And these criteria are based on years of observation, population research, medical opinion, that kind of thing. They're a guideline, but they're very, very helpful. In order to make a diagnosis, normally we would want to see at least three of those present during the previous year. Let me just go through them. A strong desire or a sense of compulsion to take the substance, that's, I guess, at the heart of it, this strong desire for it that seems overwhelming. Secondly, difficulties in controlling behaviour in terms of starting, in terms of stopping, and in terms of the amounts used. Thirdly, a physiological withdrawal state. So this is when you stop taking a substance, you get a reaction to it, withdrawal symptoms. And these can be very, very severe. So with alcohol, for example, if you're dependent on alcohol and you try to stop, there are literally about 20 different withdrawal symptoms, including things like insomnia, feeling very low in mood, hallucinations, seizures, tremors, all kinds of things. And in fact, it's possible to die from the withdrawal symptoms of alcohol. So it's not great. Then D, evidence of tolerance. That is to say that over time, you need to take more of the substance in order to get the same kind of effect that you got at a lower dose. And this is something that develops in many of the different things. Then the last two are to do with sort of social effects, so the progressive neglect of alternative pleasures and interest. In other words, the addiction kind of starts to take central place in your life. It takes increasing amounts of time finding and obtaining the substance and recovering from its effects. And finally, persisting with it, despite the fact that there is clear evidence for you that it is harmful, yet you still do it. So someone with alcohol dependence may be struggling with severe liver disease and yet will still go on drinking, or may have very, very bad mood states or depression and yet will still go on drinking, or family life and relationships are falling apart and yet still, despite the harmful consequences, continues. It's that severe when you're physically dependent. So there's six key features from a medical perspective. But what about the cause? What about the cause of these kind of things? Well, when you take a drug, either by ingesting it in your mouth or injecting it or inhaling it, it gets into your blood and then gets into your brain. And one of the reasons that these substances lead to addictions is that they act on your brain in the same way that things that your own brain normally produces. So they attach themselves to the nerves in the brain. They cause nervous activity in the pleasure centres of the brain that is pleasurable, that gives a high in a fast and intense way. So just a picture of a brain. And these are the sort of circuits that have been discovered to be involved. And this thing here called the nucleus accumbens is known as the pleasure centre, which is particularly activated by many of the psychoactive drugs. That's on a sort of whole brain level. On a kind of microscopic level, that's a picture of two nerves, the end of one and the start of another. Now, in the brain, the messaging system is electrical, in that electrical impulses pass up and down the nerve cells. But the connections between the nerves, there's this little gap here, is chemical. And what happens is that the electricity comes down, it causes a chemical reaction, and the stuff in here is released and crosses over and binds onto the end of the next nerve and causes that nerve to fire off its electrical impulse. But when you take a drug, a psychoactive drug, what happens is the drug, if you like, comes in from the outside, gets in there and binds instead of the thing that your body produces. It kind of gets in the way and will, you know, bind lots and lots and lots and fire off masses of activity at that level. And so what happens is it mimics something already in your body, but as you take it to excess compared to what your body would normally do, the feedback system means that your body stops producing the stuff here at the same levels and you become dependent on the thing from the outside. It kind of replaces the natural substance with the thing from the outside. And so this explains why over time, as that is the feedback that's reduced, you need more of the drug to get the same effect. And also why, if you suddenly stop taking the drug, you get withdrawal symptoms because your body is no longer producing the levels of this that you need for your normal sort of nervous activity. Now, that's a very basic explanation. In reality, there are a whole range of different types of nerves and different types of chemicals, and the drugs affect different ones in different ways. But very important for our discussion, though, is to say that the impact of drugs in your brain, it's not just chemical. If it was just chemical, you could sort of stop and start and the problems would go away relatively quickly. What has become clear in brain research, and I mentioned this last year, is that adult brains don't just sort of alter in terms of the chemical levels, But the wiring, if you like, changes over time. So when you learn something new, new nerve connections are made. Or if you don't do something for a long time, then the older connections sort of wither away. So the brain, if you like, is changeable. There's a technical term called neuroplasticity, which here's a sort of picture of... there we go, there's some nerves firing off, just to put that up there for you. This neuroplasticity is the key to things like memory and learning, and these sorts of changes are going on in addictions. So it's not just a chemical process, which means that to simply sort of detoxify yourself from the substance doesn't mean that the problems just goes away, because deeper changes have happened to your wiring in your brain, and those things take much, much longer to sort out, which is why, for example, someone who's an alcoholic could be free of alcohol for a long period of time, many months, even years, and just one drink, and suddenly the whole old ways of habits and learning, which are still there and haven't fully gone away, can just come back to life. They can very quickly be addicted again. So that's kind of... some of the chemistry behind and neurobiology behind substances. What about non-chemical addictions? Because the same sorts of clinical picture is seen in things like gambling addictions, pornography addictions, computer games, social media, and other things, other sort of behavioural things like that. How is it that these seem to share the same features? How can there be a sort of biological basis if there are no substances coming in from the outside and setting up that process that I talked about before? And because there's no obvious substance involved, people have often questioned whether it's legitimate to call these other behaviours addictions in the true sense. But the research is increasingly pointing towards the fact that they are very much like the classical substance addictions. Just as a way of just a little exercise for you. There's the criteria again for a substance addiction. Why don't you just have a look at that for a moment and substitute, wherever it talks about the substance, substitute for it sort of gambling or something. And just think that what that would look like. Because what you see with things like gambling and pornography use is the same kind of pattern, the same kind of things going on. And it fits with the sort of statistics as well. So I mentioned some gambling statistics at the beginning. This is some statistics from Covenant Eyes, a internet safety provider. More than 1 in 8 web searches for erotic content. 67% of children admitting to clearing their internet history, their online activity. A big problem in divorce cases, a big problem at work, and Christians are not immune from the problem as well. So it's evidence that it is an addiction. And the biological basis of these things is being worked out. So although there's no external substance coming in, those nerve changes, the neuroplasticity, seems to be the basis behind these other addictions. There is rewiring going on. This is a very useful book written by a Christian looking at some of the research to do with pornography in the male brain. And he concludes these things. Repeated exposure to pornography creates a one-way neurological superhighway where the man's mental life is over-sexualized and narrowed. And then using the illustration of water eroding into rock, he says, each time an unhealthy sexual pattern is repeated, a neurological, emotional, and spiritual erosion carves out a channel that will eventually develop into a canyon from which there is no escape. So that is to say that like hard drugs, many of these other addictions are real, and can have profound effects. So when we think about addictions then, we've got to be very clear. It's not simply a behaviour that can be started and stopped easily by just sort of simple willpower. Physical changes have happened within the brain, which is why someone can't just sort of snap out of it. You can't just snap out of it like that, pull yourself together in one instant. No, physical changes have happened. Now, another question, of course, which we think about when we think about the medical side of things and the biological side of things is this: can anybody get addicted? Or is it the case that you know, some people are wired up for it and others are not? Is it in the genes? Well, this also is another controversial subject. But it has long been observed that something like alcoholism does tend to run in families. And so one of the questions is it to do with the family's culture or is it genetics? Well, just some statistics on genetics. In 2002, a large meta-analysis, that is a sort of study of lots and lots of other studies, concluded the genetic foundations of alcoholism are modest and heterogeneous. And the sort of statistics were 20 to 26, 30 to 36% heritability. Heritability is a sort of statistical measure of the genetic contribution to individual differences that we see. So it's a sort of rough estimate of how much genes are involved in alcoholism. So it's quite clear that there is a genetic element to it, and some other studies have put the figure at more like 50%. But also, clearly, if it's this sort of level, a third to 50%, then your environment is having a significant influence as well, and family environment is significant as well. Nobody has yet been able to prove which are the genes involved. It seems like there's lots of genes, and therefore it's quite difficult to pin them down. So just to sort of summarise the genetic situation, it's genes plus a person's environment interacting that leads to addiction. When we think of genes, it's best to think in terms of vulnerability or probability rather than determination of a problem. So you're not born with a set of genes that means it's going to happen. Rather, you're born with a vulnerability or a tendency rather than an absolute certainty. And as I said, several genes are involved. And so any one individual person is unique. There's not a sort of simple disease. So put down there at the bottom, it's not an inherited disease, but an inherited vulnerability. And so some people will be more vulnerable to certain addictions than others, and some people will be much more resistant than others. I think the evidence seems to suggest that anybody could be addicted to pretty much all of the drugs if you take them enough, but that some people are very unlikely, whereas others are very likely. So that's a summary of the sort of physical side. Now, much more could be said. It's a very, very brief summary, but I hope that's helpful and clear. If you have any questions on any of that, then do please ask a little bit later. Now, a little bit more quickly, we'll run through some of the sort of psychological observations that have been done. I'm much less of an expert here, but within the NHS, in an addictions unit, although I was dealing really with the physical side of things, we worked very closely with psychologists and sociologists and people who are looking at some of these other things. So let's just think about psychology. One of the main schools of psychology is the psychoanalysis school, and the sort of big idea that they have come up with is that in addiction there is underlying psychological pain that may be subconscious, and that taking the substance or the addictive behaviour is a kind of self-medication. Now, this makes really good intuitive sense, doesn't it? And that would be the description that many who've struggled with addictions would describe their experience like, a kind of self-medication, perhaps to mask or cover up or look for some help with the problem of psychological pain of some sort. But although it fits with the experience of many addicts, it's not by any means the usual or always the way that it happens. So, for example, the studies looking at sort of personality traits and the risk of addiction don't suggest that those with the kind of depressive personalities are particularly at risk. It's rather people who are kind of impulsive or non-conformist kind of personalities that are at risk. So although this observation of the psychoanalysts is helpful, it's not the whole picture. And in fact, problems with sort of depression may often be the result of addictions rather than the cause. So the relationship is complicated. So that's the psychoanalyst. Very helpful observation there. What about the sort of behavioural psychology? Well, behaviouralists look at the effect of a behaviour on a person. And in particular, they think in terms of whether the behaviour results in positive things that reinforce that behaviour or negative things that, you know, don't encourage the habit to form. And they have just observed, pretty sort of obvious in a way, that there's a problem with addictions. If you're an addict and you engage in addictive behaviour, you get an immediate reward, an immediate high. And the adverse effects of being addicted are often delayed. So it's way down the track, the medical problems, the criminal justice problems, the relationship problems, often don't happen until well after an addiction is established. On the other hand, being sober has delayed rewards. Yeah, the reward for living in a sort of self-controlled way often is a more long-term kind of reward. There's not a sort of immediate high. And in fact, if I'm trying to be sober when I've had a problem in this area, it doesn't immediately feel very good at all. So do you see how the sort of behaviour observations are really helpful insights into how addictions can be so powerful in getting going and being reinforced? But that school of psychology is just one part of the picture. There are also a whole world of psychology called sort of cognitive psychology that looks at the way we think, the sort of patterns of thinking that we engage in. I've already mentioned the sort of personality traits and how they can predispose. But the cognitive psychologists have been very, very helpful actually at sort of criticising the behavioralists and the psychoanalysts. And they argue that the sort of behavioural and psychoanalytical approach tends to play down the reality that human beings are autonomous thinking beings. And they would say our minds are not merely like weather vanes blown by external forces, but that we do have the potential to resist things. And so the cognitive psychologists point out that addictive behaviour can be very complicated. There can be quite a lot of planning, effort and time that goes into securing and maintaining the lifestyle involved. And so although there feels like a complete loss of control before the power of the addiction, the cognitive psychologist will say it's not absolute. There is some self-regulation. And because we are rational, they very much put an emphasis on human rationality, we can be trained to use our rational thinking to combat the irrational desires involved in addictions. And so therefore, it's possible to teach people, in particular, who've become clear of the substance, to teach them how to prevent relapse. And there's a whole range of very helpful strategies for dealing with high-risk situations. What about social models then, finally, in this section? There's an awful lot that could be said here, but families are very, very important and very influential. A family culture can predispose and reinforce addictive behaviour or can be very good at helping prevent it. There's a whole range of theories that state that people pick up addictions by watching other people in their social group. The power of the peer group, if you like, is very, very significant in why people become addicted to things. Just put a slide there of some of the social benefits that sociologists have sort of classified of substance misuse. You know, going to the pub, having some drinks, can improve your social interaction. It's a chance for a bit of time out, a bit of escapism from all the difficulties and responsibilities of life. It promotes social cohesion, and it can often be a kind of anti-establishment behaviour, and there can be sort of subgroups that engage in a substance use and kind of do that for anti-establishment kind of reasons. So what we're seeing is, therefore, is that there are social and cultural factors involved in addictions that are very powerful and very important. And as I mentioned at the beginning, the journalist was pointing out globalisation, the sort of destruction of the older tight-knit communities, the new social media on the internet. All kinds of social factors are very, very important in contributing to causing and developing addictions. So we've done biological, psychological, and social. The next one is the biblical model of addiction. And I start to think about a biblical model of addiction. And the first thing I think to say, and I think I spent a bit more time on this last year, is that the Bible seems to be teaching that a human being is a body and a soul, in that the soul, as in the real you, that loves, that makes choices, that worships, that does all of those things, is enmeshed in our bodies, intimately connected, such that actually in this life you can't really separate the two. And so what we're going to look at now, when we think about particularly the Bible's teaching on sin and addiction, we're looking at the human being from a sort of spiritual perspective, and yet we are closely enmeshed with our physicality as well. So it's actually quite difficult really to separate the two apart. So I hope we won't get too confused by something which is actually a mystery, how we are a body and a soul. So I say that by way of introducing. Let's think about the Bible's teaching on addictive kind of behaviours. And if you want a key verse to take away, it's this. Jesus replied, "I tell you the truth, everyone who sins is a slave to sin." Now, when it comes to addictions, we can't help also to consider issues of morality and moral issues. And to do so, when we look at the Bible, we can't help but think about the Bible's teaching on the subject of sin. Now, I realise that introducing the idea of sin and moral responsibility is fraught with danger when we're talking about addictions. For those who have deeply struggled with addictions, you may have been greatly hurt by the way people have spoken to you about responsibility for your actions and the way blame perhaps has felt apportioned to you. And so there is a danger. The idea of sin can be used as a big stick to beat us with. And if you struggle with addictions, I guess you already feel guilty enough as it is. So the aim now is not to try and make us feel guilty or to try and beat us with a stick. But we want to just look at the reality of human nature. What are we really like according to the Bible? And how can we get help with our addictive tendencies? Because what I'm going to say really affects every single one of us. Every single one of us since the time of Adam has within our hearts the seeds and the outworkings of every kind of addiction. So to use a medical analogy, if we're going to get help with addictions, we need to get the right diagnosis. What is the heart of the issue, the heart of the human problem? Now, each of the secular models we've been looking at so far are really, really helpful, I guess you would agree. But they're only helpful to a point. They're any part of the picture. Do you remember that diagram from the beginning? We don't want to miss out on the heart of the issue, what it means to be a spiritual creature made in the image of God. And according to the Bible, the biggest problem that faces the human race is our sinfulness. That is our primary and deepest problem that we need rescuing from, all of us. And addictions, I want to suggest, can be viewed as an outworking and a form of sinful thinking and behaviour. Now, it is therefore important to define what sin means in the Bible. And where we're introduced to the subject of sin first is in the third chapter of Genesis, when we see the first human beings do the original sinful act, which is to declare independence from God, their loving creator. It's to rebel from his loving rule and to set themselves up, if you like, as little gods, saying, I'm going to decide what's right and wrong for me in my life. I'm in charge. And the result of that step of declaring independence from God, shaking our fists at God, is that our perspectives on the world and on our relationships becomes curved in. That's what the Bible teaches. We become curved in on ourselves. We become self-centered. And so sin is sometimes described to Sunday school children as a three-letter word with I in the middle. That is sinfulness. And so when you look at sinfulness like this, it's purposeful, it's high-handed, and it's voluntary. But here's the problem. When we think about addictions, we've been thinking about something which feels out of control, which feels like a bondage. And therefore, I guess you might be thinking, well, how can you say that's sinful if it feels like it's out of my control? For a start, I might say, well, we don't want to feel guilty about our brain chemistry necessarily and the state we may be in. But the Bible, I think, does tell us a bit more about sinfulness than what I've just already said. And that is to say this, that when we give ourselves to this self-centeredness, we also become under its power. And so there's this picture in the Bible of sin as a power, as a slavery, if you like. It captures us. And so a very, very famous and important book in the history of the church was written by the German Martin Luther, and he called it The Bondage of the Will. And he argues in that every single human being, since the first humans in the Garden of Eden, having rebelled, we are now by nature in bondage to our sinfulness. So it's what Jesus said in that verse, when anyone sins, he is a slave to sin. So I thought I'd just read out a couple of passages from the Apostle Paul's letter to the Romans, and just to see how he describes sin in terms of this slavery. So he asks the question, and he's speaking to people who are Christians here, shall we sin because we are not under law but under grace? By no means. Actually, if you'd like to turn this up, it's Romans chapter 6. I did mean to tell you. It's page 1133 in your church Bibles. It would be good, wouldn't it, to pick up a Bible and have a look at a Bible together. So I'll give you a moment to get there, and then I'll read. Okay, the rustling is going down slightly, so I'll read. Chapter 6, verse 15. What then? Shall we sin because we are not under law but under grace? By no means. Don't you know that when you offer yourselves to someone to obey him as slaves, you are slaves to the one to whom you obey? Whether you are slaves to sin, which leads to death, or to obedience, which leads to righteousness. But thanks be to God that though you used to be slaves to sin, you wholeheartedly obeyed the form of teaching to which you were entrusted. You have been set free from sin and have become slaves to righteousness. So the Apostle Paul is clearly describing the state of natural humanity as enslaved to our sin, to our sinful desires. And even when he looks at it from the perspective of a Christian, he says in the next chapter, even now we wrestle with these things. I do not understand what I do, for what I want to do, I do not do, and what I hate, I do. As it is no longer I myself who do it, but it is sin living in me. So we've got this picture then in the Bible of sin as a dominion. We become captured by our desires. Sin becomes, if you like, our master. And so we sin actually because these desires that we have, we want to sin. We're under its dominion, and yet we want to do it because the problem is our desires. We don't want to stop doing it, because we don't want to stop doing it, and we want to do it because we want to do it. So it's a bondage of our desires, or as Luther put it, a bondage of our wills. And so therefore, I think the Bible is teaching that sin's got a sort of dual nature. It is both shrewdly calculating and voluntary, and yet at the same time, it is also out of control. We become enslaved and addicted. So I think it's really, really helpful just to see the Bible's teaching there, because if this is the case, it does fit, doesn't it, with some of the things we've been thinking about in terms of addiction. A purposeful, voluntary decision that leads to being enslaved and addicted. A key image in the Bible for sin is the image of idolatry. That's the worship of anything that is not the Creator. And a sin in that level is described as worship. It's what we desire, what we consider the highest value in our lives. And when you look at the Bible's teaching on idolatry and idols, what you see is rather similar to what happens in the process of how someone becomes addicted. You see this process. Think of the nation of Israel when they came into the promised land and how they began in little small ways to start to sin and to sort of excuse it. It was just a little thing. But then over time, they become more acquainted and friendly with their idols, the Baals. And then over time, it becomes a sort of infatuation, and it starts to cost the Israelites. God starts to bring difficult things to them, but they still do it. And then finally, it's a love for these idols that means they betray the God that rescued them. So what the picture we get then in the Bible is, if you like, a voluntary slavery in terms of what sin is. It's a choice and a power, and it's a tendency that every single one of us has within us since the first human beings. So that's in brief something I think of the Bible's teaching relevant to addictions. How can we just pull these things together, these different models? A question we might ask: are addictions sinful then, given what we've looked at? Well, in some senses, yes. But in some senses, no. Because some of the changes that have happened in our brains, well, it's become like a disease, hasn't it? Is addiction a sickness, therefore, or a sin? That was the question on the publicity for this. Well, I want to suggest that actually it's a false choice between the two, because addictions show features of both. There are sinful choices involved. There are sinful desires involved and passions. And yet it produces this disease-like process in the brain. And so I want to suggest that we need a hybrid model. We've got sinful choices on the one hand, which leads to this bondage, which can be viewed as a spiritual bondage and also as a physical disorder or disease. And we've seen, haven't we, the sort of biochemical and physical dependent state, the rewiring that happens. And it's a really tragic kind of bondage because the consequences of it are huge. We looked at some of the social costs at the beginning, but many of the costs of addiction, they can't be calculated. The damage to relationships in particular, as the addiction replaces relationships in our lives, the pain that causes can hardly be counted. All sin, according to the Bible, ultimately has negative consequences for us. It's anti-God, it's anti-self, it's anti-social. And all sin is at root that process, both of saying, I'm in charge, and that bondage to slavery that I was talking about. But yet different sins have different consequences, and some much more severe than others. And I think we have to recognize that addiction, if we're to view it as having a sinful component to it, has very serious consequences, doesn't it? It affects everything in the end. It affects our relationships. If I'm a Christian, it affects my spiritual life because I've got a rival to God in my heart. And it, of course, affects my health and it may kill me as well in the end. One of the books I've put down there, possible further reading, it's got this very vivid title, a brilliant title, describes addictions as a banquet in the grave. Because that's what it is in the end, a banquet in the grave. So how can we deal with addictions? Well, I fear this section is now going to be rather too brief, but I'll have a go. How can we deal with addictions? Well, we've got our biological, psychological, social, and spiritual dimensions to think about. When you're thinking about sort of the more medical addictions, there are two phases to treatment. The first is the acute, immediate phase, and then there's longer-term stuff. In the short term, what you need is to be detoxified of the substance. And as we saw earlier, that withdrawal symptoms can be very severe, and so it's not just possible to just stop necessarily by yourself, particularly with things like alcohol or heroin. And in fact, in alcohol, there's 5% of people who get alcohol withdrawal, will end up with very severe hallucinations and tremors and can have epileptic fits. So it's dangerous, in fact. So what happens is that a lot of people will be admitted to hospital, you will have a period of 7 to 10 days, approximately, where you give an alternative drug to the drug of addiction and tailor it down gradually over 7 to 10 days in a controlled environment, detoxify the person. And one of my jobs as a sort of junior doctor on the ward was basically to manage all these detoxifications. And it usually worked very well, as long as the person was willing to stay in the hospital. Some people did just get up and leave halfway through, but if they stayed, it was relatively easy to do. And I suspect, even in the case of addictions that are not to substances, we can quite easily have a detox. I don't know, you go on holiday for 2 weeks, you change your environment, and the addiction can fade away. The detox bit is the easy bit. The problem is the next stage, which in the secular world is rehabilitation or rehab. And this is learning to live without the drug or the thing of addiction. And this is a process that takes months. And this is where all the psychological and social things come in the secular world. Sometimes rehab is residential, and it usually involves trying to sort of set up a whole new lifestyle and to change deeply held habits. So it's a chance to think about potential causes of psychological pain. I talked about before, the chance to talk about the things that may be underlying the use of the addiction thing. It's a chance to look at ways of changing the behavioural reinforcement, having negative consequences when you take a substance and having really positive things happen to you when you stay clear of it. It's a chance for some cognitive therapy to think, how am I going to plan and prepare for dangerous moments to prevent relapse? And of course, very importantly, it's a chance to form new social groups and new relationships. And this is where groups like Alcoholics and Narcotics Anonymous have been incredibly helpful and successful over the last 80 years or so in providing a fellowship and accountability and mutual support. And it also involves change of lifestyle, possibly trying to find a new job, all kinds of things like that. It's a very labour-intensive and difficult process. And whereas detox is relatively straightforward, the rehab is more difficult. So, for example, with heroin, there's a 40% relapse rate at 6 months after detox. And the vast majority have, in fact, relapsed within a year. So it's very difficult, the rehabilitation process. One of the reasons is, of course, your social situation can often be very difficult to change. And if the social risk factors are all still there, you might fall back into the addiction. But also the neurological changes, the neuroplasticity, if that is true, and the evidence seems to suggest it is, then the brain connections that you've made, your habit-formed neural circuits in the brain, they're not just going to change overnight. They may be there for years. And this is one of the reasons why the majority of people who are addicted to the more severe drugs will need to have as their goal complete abstinence of whatever the substance is. Now, I have come across situations where that was not necessary. Occasionally, you will get some younger alcoholics, for example, who are highly motivated. They've caught the process early on, and a more sort of controlled, what's called controlled drinking, may be helpful. But for the majority of severe addictions, abstinence is without doubt the best approach. It's so severe that any kind of moderation is just not going to work. And certainly pretty much all the people I saw would have been in that category, although I was working at the more severe end of things. So the situation is difficult. Abstinence may be necessary, but it's not hopeless, because we can, even on just a human level, lay down new pathways in the brain to reinforce a new way of life. So the book, Struthers' book, about pornography, and he's really speaking from the Christian perspective, he says this: if the corrupted neural pathway can be avoided, a new pathway can be formed. We can establish a healthy sexual pattern where the flow is directed towards holiness rather than towards corrupted intimacy. And by deepening the holiness pathway, it becomes part of our embodied nature. So new habits, new nerve pathways, and a new way of life. But what about specific Christian ways of thinking about getting out of addictions? Because I do think we have something special to offer in this area. I put that on your handout. Head, heart, and will. A simple sort of overview. Help from the Bible for addictions. It means dealing with the whole of our person, hence head, heart, and will. The head is the understanding. And a lot of what we've been doing tonight is simply to try and increase our understanding so that we understand what goes on. And if I've not got an addiction problem and we've looked at this stuff, it should tell us we want to stay well clear, don't we, if we understand the process that can go on. If I have got an addiction problem, then understanding it is really, really helpful and is the first step on the road to recovery. And it might be that understanding the situation means I need to turn to the medical help if it's severe. Well, there's the head. What about the heart? What's the heart in the Bible? It's not the pump that pumps blood around. It's actually the same word that's sometimes translated as mind. It's the center of our personalities. It's the part of us that decides whether we like or dislike something. It's the part of us that decides whether to worship something or not. It's the part of us that is related to our desires and the things that we might worship and idolize. And it's at this level, I think the Bible teaches, that the heart drives our behavior more strongly even than our understanding. And so you could be a thoroughly educated person about addictions and yet still have an addiction problem, because you don't, the desire to keep going with it is stronger than the desire to stop. I thought what would be quite good is to read a passage from the Bible looking at how Jesus dealt with someone's heart. It's John chapter 4 and the Samaritan woman. So Jesus has got to go through Samaria. It's a very hot day. He stops at a well to get a drink. And he meets a woman of Samaria. This is what happens. Let me read from verse 7. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. And the Samaritan woman said to him, "You're a Jew, and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?" Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." "Sir," the woman said, "you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob?" So Jesus is having this conversation with the woman, and she starts to realize that he's not talking about physical water, but he's talking about spiritual things. And what we see is a woman who is spiritually thirsty. Look down at verse 16. Jesus says to her, "Go and call your husband and come back." "I have no husband," she replied. Jesus said to her, "You are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you have had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have just said is quite true." "Sir," the woman said, "I can see that you are a prophet." Well, here's this woman who is addicted, it appears, to serial relationships. Each one perhaps satisfies for a time, and then she moves on to another. And this sixth man of hers, well, she's given up calling it marriage. And look at verse 13. It's almost like the water here is a bit like the image of an addiction. Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. It's a water that quenches the thirst, but only for a time you'll be thirsty again." And that's what addictions are like. There's a desire, there's a high, and then there's a crash, and then the craving all over again. It never satisfies, the emptiness. So here's this Samaritan woman, an unfulfilled addict. But then Jesus presents himself, I'll put it down on the sheet, as the one who gives true life. Verse 13, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give him will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." Now, of course, he's not talking about H2O, he's talking about the Holy Spirit. If we come to Jesus, he makes his dwelling in us, and by the power of the Holy Spirit, he gives us new life and true satisfaction. And the heart of this new life, this eternal life, involves a new relationship with God. It's a restored relationship with the God that we rejected, now back in relationship with him, a new object of worship. And so Jesus, put down on your sheet, becomes the true object of our worship. No longer making an idol of those various addictions, the answer to that is to have Jesus at the center. The book I mentioned at the beginning has these quite important words. "Perhaps the crucial feature of addictions is the progressive replacement of people by things." So addiction involves the replacement of a desire for relationships with a desire for things. So the problem is not necessarily the desire to be satisfied, but it's rather what we choose to seek that satisfaction in and the way we do it, selfishly or not. And the solution, I think the Bible teaches, is not to sort of remove our desires, but reorientate them and put them on someone who can truly satisfy and who truly deserves our worship. So it's not removal of desires, but replacement. A replacement of an idolatry with a relationship with the Lord. And so he gives us living water, his Holy Spirit. Far better than any physical water, because when you have it, you will never thirst again. And it leads to eternal life. So the ultimate solution is found in Christ, according to the Bible. Here's a quote about C.S. Lewis, a quote by C.S. Lewis, speaking about desires. I'll just read from the second sentence down. He says, "It would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong but too weak. We're half-hearted creatures fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea, we are far too easily pleased." Far too easily pleased by our addictions. Or as the famous Scottish preacher Thomas Chalmers put it, "When it comes to addictions, what we need to experience is the expulsive power of a new affection. Something that captivates our heart, that is more powerful than the desires related to the addiction. So it's replacement with a new desire, a new relationship that is so much better that it drives out the other one. And for long-term rehabilitation, this replacement is key. And I would suggest that the Christian good news gives us something better than any other form of replacement. It gives us eternal life, a relationship with the God who made us, a restored relationship so that we are captivated by his love for us and we respond in turn by loving him. So that's the heart section, a new heart if we're Christian. It doesn't mean that our old desires all vanish, but it does mean that this desire is greater than all the others. And weak as we are, as we hold on to him, we can expect progress in this area. And then finally, I'll just put down there some practical steps. And I think I'll just briefly skate over those. Hate the sin, hate the wrongdoing. Trust in the Lord. The Samaritan woman was blown away by the way he demonstrated love to her. And we're going to sing in a moment of his redemption on the cross for us, that we can be forgiven and loved. So hate the sin, trust the Lord, and then in response, love the Lord. That's how to grow. As we grow in our love for him, we'll find power to fight other things. And then finally, I've put down there some practical steps. It is very wise to take practical steps to avoid addiction. If an alcoholic needs to have a policy of complete abstinence, it is also the case, I think, that the Bible teaches that we should have a policy of complete abstinence from sin. Now, that's not actually going to be possible to achieve, but Paul uses the language, put it to death, put it to death. Our attitude should be, put it to death. And then finally, I've put down there, be accountable to others. Walk in the light. The church family is the ultimate fellowship of relationships to help us. So expect progress rather than perfection. But if we're Christian, we're not on our own. Jesus promises his Holy Spirit to live with us and be in us. So we shouldn't lose heart, but keep on battling against our addictions. Better stop there. It's just gone 9:30, so I'll hand back to Alex, and there'll be some chance for questions, I think.
Brilliant. Before we do questions, there's obviously a lot of hard work gone into this. Why don't we just show Nick our appreciation for all this hard work? I've got my lovely assistant at the back with a microphone. Andrew's going to come round if you've got a question. We'll just do maybe 5 minutes of questions. We didn't really have a definite end time, but it's 9:30 already. But if there are questions, please do ask them. Again, the great benefit of doing these talks in-house is that Nick's around every weekend, so we can always ask him later on as well. But are there any questions that people would like to ask from the floor now? Over here down the front.
Just a couple of questions, actually, if I may. Firstly, briefly, would you have any idea or opinion on why addictions seem to be so prevalent in the medical personnel, amongst doctors and nurses?
Oh, right.
Secondly, would you have any ideas on helping, how to help people who refuse to go down the route of the AA, which requires, as its number one 12-step program, belief in a higher power? Yeah. If a person has absolutely no belief in a higher power, did you come across this in your work, and how would you try to help that person, or would you, you okay. lead them to simply get to that point?
The first question, I don't know the figures, so I don't know if it's any worse than any other sphere of life. It may be that it is. you know, if you're very busy and stressed, you can use, you know, various drugs or alcohol as a way of coping, can't you? So I think it's quite well known, at least historic, that junior doctors would drink quite a bit. I suppose in the past they may have had access to things more than others. That wouldn't be the case now. But maybe just knowledge can be a dangerous thing, can't it? You know, you sort of have some knowledge of how these things work and you might be tempted to try it out, if you know what I mean. I don't know. So I don't know whether there's any evidence.
All people should have a greater knowledge of what they're doing to themselves, and yet there's still this seeming compulsion, because the statistics are very, very high in the medical profession.
It shows that the heart of the problem isn't to do with whether you are educated well or not. It's the desires, I think. As to the second question, where I worked in South London, I wouldn't really describe our service as particularly... It didn't have a particularly close relationship with AA, actually, Alcoholics Anonymous. And there were other options. So there were other approaches, other sort of support groups that were available. So in South London, if you didn't want to go to AA, there were other things. So it depends on the context and where they're at. There may be other approaches. So, you know, you don't have to believe in God, I don't think, to necessarily make progress in this area. I do believe that the best solution is found in Christ, is what I've been saying. I mean, AA, as far as I'm not an expert on the history of AA, but as far as I understand it, it did start off as a Christian charity, and it's kind of broadened out its sort of the way it sort of markets and describes itself. Just to speak of a higher power in general. I think there are people who would be atheists who go anyway, and kind of, I don't know how it works for them, but yeah. Anyway, sorry, long-winded answer. But,
great, thank you very much for your question. Any other questions from the floor? Up at the back. Thank you, Andrew.
This is a partly semi-serious question, but, I mean, can there be good addictions? I notice in Romans 6, Paul goes on to talk about, you know, after talking about slaves to sin, he talks about becoming slaves to righteousness and to God. And I think Marx described religion as the opium of the people. So, you know, can it be turned to good advantage, this addiction?
I think Marx probably meant it in a negative way.
I mean, one can even become, you know, an obsessive churchgoer or, you know, some religious habit that almost becomes an addiction.
Paul describes himself at the start of many of his letters as a servant or slave of Christ. And in a sense, that's a description of any Christian, actually. We are... whether we subjectively feel it or not, we are objectively his servants, slaves. So I think, what I was sort of saying it towards the end was the solution isn't to kind of remove any slavery, but it's actually is whom do you serve? So sort of, is that sort of Bob Dylan or something? You've got to serve somebody. Who is it going to be? Or what is it going to be? So, yeah, replacement rather than removal. Yeah. Is that helpful?
Thank you. I think we've got time perhaps just for one more question. Oh, Mark jumped on that one really quick.
We all know of, or Christians know of, and we've seen conversion experiences which have had a very dramatic effect on the convertee. Even to the extent of removing addiction from substance, etc. And there's many, many examples of that. And I was intrigued by what you were saying about pathways in the brain and how they are reshaped and reformed by certain addictive substances. And the conversion experience obviously does something to that potentially, which could be quite different. So that's one point. The other point, which you didn't really emphasize, Nick, but I know it's quite obvious, is that there is a spiritual death and there's a spiritual rebirth in the conversion experience, which obviously would then have quite an extreme result, potentially, on somebody in their life and in the things that they are addicted to, whether they are a substance or a lifestyle or a pattern of behavior, etc. Can you comment on those two elements and the extent to which it was they kind of were factored into, or in the extent to which you considered them when you were doing the research? It's a very open, vague question.
The second question, I suppose, when you look at the Bible's teaching about sin, there are various different images given to describe it, or metaphors. Say spiritual death would be one. Idolatry would be another. Foolishness would be another. Even sickness, in fact, it's described as being like a sickness. I just felt, with the limitations of time, I would sort of focus on one. And so I particularly focused on the sort of bondage of our desires and the idolatry, because they seem particularly related to the subject of addictions. But yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely, that it's true and holds. With regards to dramatic changes, I'm just trying to think if I could think of anyone. I mean, when I became a Christian, a certain behaviour stopped, and I'd look back on it and think it was a complete miracle, because there was no way that I wanted to stop it up until the moment I became a Christian. But then I could also look at my Christian life for the last 15 years, and there are certain other behaviours that haven't stopped and have proved incredibly resistant. So I think being a Christian is being delivered, and sometimes we can have a wonderful deliverance, and yet at the same time the Bible teaches that sin hasn't gone completely, and therefore there'll be some areas of our lives that there's an ongoing battle, which was the second reading from Romans 7 that Paul describes, I think, a Christian experience of that battle. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe one day.
It's a mystery, isn't it, as to why sometimes some things we seem to find deliverance from and other things seem to be an ongoing struggle. I guess anyone here who's following Christ will be able to testify to that, I imagine.
Thank you, Mark, for your question. That's all we've got time for with questions from the floor. Nick, this is obviously a much bigger subject. You kind of just brought us into the middle of it. If someone wanted to be finding out more, you know, what would be the next step?
I really struggled actually to think of one. There's no one book that, to my mind, captures it in a simple way for us. But I've put four down there. The first one is this Addictions: A Banquet in the Grave. It's a very good book, and I found it really, really helpful. It's a little bit long-winded, but apart from that, I think it's good. So if you want to get hold of that, ask Alison. For it. Captured by a Better Vision is specifically about Christians struggling with pornography, and it's a very well-written book, very helpful. Wired for Intimacy, that's a little bit more technical. I haven't got a copy here. It's the one on the brain circuitry. But it's a good book, but a bit more technical. And The Fix, that's a very easy-to-read journalist talking about stuff. And I didn't finish it, but what he was saying seemed to be, you know, reasonably sound. I think he's a Roman Catholic, actually. He is a Roman Catholic. So he's not, his kind of worldview isn't too dissimilar from what I've kind of been suggesting. So.
Great. If you're interested in any of those, you can chat to Alison Elkin, or if you chat to the church office on a Sunday, I'm sure they'll be able to help you get hold of those as well. Nick, thank you so much for all your hard work.